Yahweh's Design, a True Sleep Line Israelite Ministry with Pastor Dan. Now here's Pastor Dan.
Welcome everybody to By Yahweh's Design. I am Pastor Dan, your host for this 1 hour live radio program coming to you over the Heritage Broadcasting System. We wish to welcome all of our kinsmen around the globe who are listening tonight via computers on the internet, over C-band satellite, FM radio, thanks to those brave rebroadcasters, shortwave, and 4D TV, channel 954. We ask Yahweh, our Heavenly Father, to bless each and every one of you. First and foremost, we wish to dedicate this program to our Heavenly Father, Yahweh, who is the father of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who was later surnamed Israel. For all good things come from him, and we wish to give him all the praise, the glory, and the honor, for allowing us this opportunity to bring his truth to his holy remnant, the lost sheep of the house of Jacob Israel, also known as the Caucasian or Covenant peoples of the earth. Hallelujah, praise Yahweh in Paleo-Hebrew. We are a two-seed line, racial covenant identity ministry, and we've been studying this truth for a good number of years now. However, at no time do we claim to be perfect, and therefore do encourage your participation. So please have your pens and pencils handy, as we'll be giving out the phone number for here and also other information during the broadcast. Tonight's a little bit of an exception. We do not anticipate taking any callers. If that changes, I'll give out the call-in number later on in the program. Due to the nature of my guest, I'm going to keep the phone lines shut off tonight. Tonight's program is entitled Oklahoma City, The News Behind the News. And our guest is retired General Ben Parton from Virginia. And I'll be asking the General to step up to the mic and speak here in just a minute, but I want to give you a couple addresses in the meantime. And again, our program tonight will be Oklahoma City, The News Behind the News. We also highly encourage the support for Heritage Broadcasting System, folks. They're doing a bang-up job of trying to get through the veil of silence of the major media and bring you programming that's going to give you information you're just not going to get anywhere else. This takes effort, and it also takes money. So please prayerfully consider not only supporting us or Heritage. And you can write to Heritage in care of Post Office Box 5583, Evansville, Indiana, 47716. Or visit their website at the letter H broadcast. com. That's www.hbroadcast.com. Many people have health concerns today. We highly recommend a consultation with Judy Nips at Salt Box Herbs, and you can reach her in Pennsylvania at this phone number, area code 724-639-9607. Again, this is the 25th of April, year 2001. We just passed the anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. And it's my great pleasure to introduce to you retired United States Air Force General Ben Parton. Welcome to the program, General.
My pleasure to be on your program, Dan.
And it's our pleasure to have you, sir. I have to tell you and the listening audience, it was my pleasure to listen to you live in West Virginia about 5 or 6 years ago, I believe it was, when you spoke to a Bible conference. And I think you gave 3 one-hour lectures during that weekend. And one of them was over the Oklahoma City bombing, which had just recently occurred. And then the other two lectures were on international communism. And if it's okay with you, I'd like to cover both of those issues tonight. Would that be okay?
Very good. you'll get
okay.
All in 1 hour.
Well, yeah, exactly. It may take us longer than that, in which case I'll be certainly glad to have you come back on. But so to get the ball rolling, since it is just past the anniversary of Oklahoma City, I believe it would be paramount for us to first address the valuable information I think you have on what really went down in Oklahoma City.
Well, I guess you're just giving me the opportunity to tell you what I understand about it.
Yes, sir.
Well, I think you and many people around the country are aware that just a few days, a week and a half, less than a week and a half after the bombing in Oklahoma, because of my in-depth background in the weapons and the design of weapons and terminal ballistics and the effects of weapons and what you can do, and I knew very quickly that the FBI was lying about what happened in Oklahoma. And I went down to Senator Nichols' office trying to get him to take some steps to get an independent investigation going on. And 2 days later, his assistant called and told me that there was a lot of difference of opinion with respect to what happened in Oklahoma. I decided they weren't going to do anything, so I sent a letter to, I think, about 80 congressmen and senators trying to get them to keep that building from coming down and being buried, because I knew they would dispose of the evidence as soon as possible, because, you know, it was a big cover-up.
Right.
And that letter wasn't successful in stopping the building from coming down, and I was invited down to Oklahoma to speak to a bunch of the legislators, as well as surviving family members and the press, and some of the members of the Oklahoma Assembly. Charles Key and others were trying to get an independent investigation underway, and that didn't happen. But while I was there, I had the opportunity to get a lot of photographic verification of the analysis that I had done and sent to all the senators and congressmen. And that report went independently to every senator and every congressman and about 1,000 of various media outlets. And there was no question but what there has been a very big cover-up, and 6 years history now and further information. We know that there are a lot of people involved in it, and I think the terminal end of this, all of what has happened in the last 6 years, is this brand new book that has just come out, The American Terrorist, McVeigh, and the bombing in Oklahoma City. And that document I consider almost a disinformation program, and I'll tell you why. A few days, the book came out the first of this month, and I was about 2 weeks into last month. I was called by one of the authors, and he told me, he asked a bunch of questions. Well, when he finished asking me questions, I had a bunch of questions for him. So I asked if he would care to mind asking a few questions for me about his interview. And he very quickly came back and he said, I did not interview McVeigh, it was the other guy. I'd like to have somebody call the other guy and see if he interviewed McVeigh. But if you look at what is stated in the book and what McVeigh has claimed to have said in the book, McVeigh would know that what they're saying is a lie. And he would know that he is lying. The one man, one bomb thesis is written all over it. And no others involved, and McVeigh knows very well there were a number of Middle Eastern people involved. He knows there are a number of people involved in that effort. It wasn't a simple truck bomb outside. And the book is just full of things which I consider pretty much the FBI lying on what happened throughout the bombing. Because of what has come out recently about the criticism of, I guess, let's go skip and go back. I was getting off onto the Oklahoma thing. We don't talk about that. We just talked about the Waco thing. We're just talking about Oklahoma. So if you look at what has happened in the bombing in Oklahoma, the first reports that came out said there was 1,200 pounds of explosives, and then they upped it 4,000 pounds of explosives, and then the 4,800 pounds of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil. Well, the blast equivalent ammonium nitrate and fuel oil is about 0.27 pounds per pound of TNT. And if you look at FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, came out with a report in conjunction with the American Society of Civil Engineers, and I don't know how they talked the American Society of Civil Engineers into putting out such a foolish report. They said that their forensic work was done from 200 feet away. Mind you, this is an official report now of two of a government agency and a civilian agency. Under the auspices of FEMA, they turned out this report. It was a very nice report. You can go to FEMA and get it. It's a propaganda piece about a quarter of an inch thick, full color, free. So you know it's propaganda. Anything that you get for free out of the government printing office is propaganda. So if you pay for it, it's made out of credibility. But anyway, the FEMA report said, looked at the crater size out in front of the building and said, that size crater, 28 feet across and 6.8 feet deep, would have required, from Army parametric data, it would have required 4,000 pounds of TNT. Well, 4,000 pounds of TNT is a blast equivalent of 14,800 pounds. Now, in this new book, The American Terrorist, McVeigh and the Bombing of Oklahoma, McVeigh claims in there, whoever wrote the thing is claiming that McVeigh says the truck bomb was 7,000 pounds of AFNO, ammonium nitrate and fuel oil, plus nitromethane. Now, if you have nitromethane and AFNO, anthylamine, and they're properly mixed to give you the proper balance and properly mixed, not only the combination there, but properly mixed, you would have about a blast equivalent of 1 pound of that mixture per pound of TNT. So if McVeigh's bomb was 7,000 pounds, as they were saying in that book, then that would have given you the blast equivalent of about 26,000 pounds of ANFO, ammonium nitrate and fuel oil. Now, the real significant thing here is if you look at the crater, you know, when you have a bomb go off, you've got all kinds of effects. You've got the blast damage that reaches out to a certain extent. You may have fragmentation from something, but the fragmentation from the truck was essentially nil compared to the fragmentation from, say, a bomb. And you also have a crater. When you have that large of an explosion, slightly elevated above a concrete or concrete and asphalt roadbed. And when you have that kind of a large explosion over a concrete road or concrete and asphalt, you get a lip of crater. You'll get a crater and proportional, and it's not proportional, but it is a function of the blast effectiveness and what kind of explosive you're using. But you'll get a crater. And that crater will always have a lip on it. And it's based on just the hydrodynamic ramming of the clay and gravel or whatever is under that roadbed out at the extremes of the crater. And you have a very low angle of incidence, so the blast wave removed from, the truck bomb. And as that angle of incidence gets down, you're pushing against a big solid slab of concrete, very, very wide, with almost infinite mass then for a very short impulse time. And so you get a lip of concrete sticking over the rim of that hole. And if you don't have it, if you don't have the rim, somebody's lying. If you look at the crater outside of the Murrah building, Mr. Diefenbaugh, the chief oak bomb investigator, came to my home and said, put his finger on the picture of that crater in my report and said, suppose I told you that was not the crater. I didn't respond to his comment. I just thought, well, I know some things that he knows too, so I didn't go through any detail on it. But the thing is, the picture of the crater did not have a lip. Now, did they take a tremendous power-driven jackhammer or vehicle there? Had they knocked the rim off to remove the vulnerability before they filled it in? I don't know, but the crater did not have a rim. And so if it didn't have the rim, then the diameter that they were giving would have been increased somewhat. But you can scale the crater, the picture of the crater, and it was something on the order of 16 feet, not 28 feet, as indicated in the FEMA, American Society of Civil Engineering, analysis. So there's so many things that do not tie together. And when you keep up in the size of the exposure, trying to claim some credibility for destroying the building, you have the same effect. You're generating a larger and larger crater. And that crater has some very, very specific geometry. And we learned all about those interfaces with large explosives like that over concrete when we were developing the runway cratering munition for, you know, Air Force applications. And so, therefore, the bombing in Oklahoma, the bomb that was used, there's been a tremendous amount of cover-up. The book that has just been put out, I do not consider a valid book because there are too many things in there that McVeigh knows would not be true that they're implying that he had said. And the guy may be lying, too. But if you look at the book, it's pretty much totally consistent with what the FBI has been saying and advertising about the bombing in Oklahoma from the beginning. And so I think the credibility of the whole court case that was handled out in Denver, the FBI brought over from England a technical expert, a lady who had some background looking at the and analyzing some of the terrace craters in the United Kingdom, and she was used over here for. As a technical expert, and I dare say I served on a joint committee with, when I was in the military, with the people from the UK and Canada and France and Germany, in some harmonization efforts that worked in the weapons area, and I know for a fact that most of these other countries have a very, very, very meager, effort underway, compared to what the United States has done in the weapons and explosives and area. So I don't take my hat off to any of these other countries and their expertise in weapons. But they brought this lady over, and she was their expert witness. Now, when Mr. Diefenbach came to my home to question me about my analysis of the bombing in Oklahoma, I knew he would never come here unless he had realized there was a lot of credibility in it. He brought two of the prosecutors that was participating in the trial out in Denver, and the lady prosecutor who was asking the questions of the UK specialist, they talked about the effect of the bomb on the moving vehicles around and across the street. They talked about the fragmentation of the truck and where various pieces were. They talked about the glass being shattered in buildings and damaged the buildings in the general area, but they never mentioned, they never talked about what was across the street, across the sidewalk from that truck. They never talked about the effect of that bomb on the building or how it could possibly have brought it down or how it collapsed. They didn't mention it. They completely skirted it. So now, here we are now down to I guess McVeigh is supposed to be executed on the 16th of next month. And the truth has never been officially reported by any government report that I know of. I think there are lots of witnesses that should have been called in Denver who were not called. You had Elohim City, which is supposedly a neo-Nazi right-wing kind of a group there, fairly close in Oklahoma. And Strassmeyer was there. He was the son, he was a graduate of the, actually when he came to Washington, living in the Washington area, came over here. And I understand that that was arranged way back then when he came over to this country. Three, I understand, was a person who arranged for him to come over here, and he was working with a CIA person in the Greater Washington area for a while before he went out to Elohim City. And out at Elohim City, we know that McVeigh tried to reach him, and I'm not sure how much contact there was with Strassmeyer, but here you had Elohim City, and one of the people out there had reported to their ATF handler. Another paid ATF informant, she had reported that they were going to hit the building, and I guess she was prosecuted They tried to back away from her, denying that she was working for them when she was, and they tried to prosecute her with a jury trial, and the whole thing was thrown out because they were trying to prosecute her for what they had hired her. So you had four people. Number one, Mr. Millar, who was reported to be an FBI paid informant, and he was a guru for the whole thing. You had Carol Howe, the lady who was paid by the ATF. You had Strassmeyer there, brought over here by the, I understand, by somebody in the FBI. And one other person who was a paid informant. How many others out there, I don't know, were there. But here you have an institution that was imputed to have been involved to a certain extent in that bombing. And many of these people were being paid by United States agencies. We know there were a lot of Middle Eastern people involved in that bombing. And but I think one of the most significant things is that there were several surveillance cameras folks around that had information on them about the Murrah building. One across the parking lot covered that entrance on the street, the north side of the building covered where the truck was, and that parking lot is a security camera, in call it, the TV. And we know the FBI picked up that the film from that surveillance camera. There are other surveillance cameras around in other buildings that they confiscated. But all it is needed to reconcile and determine whether they were exposed as charges inside the building or whether it's just a truck bomb is for the FBI to release that surveillance camera film. I know Charles Key had submitted an FOI, Freedom of Information, request for that film, and the FBI came back and said, well, we've located the film you're after, the pictures you're after, but they're not releasable. So all it is needed for the American people to know whether there were bombs inside the building or just the truck bomb outside is to see that surveillance camera film. And, of course, they're not going to show it. If you look at the pictures around the building hours after the bomb was set off, the truck bomb was set off, there's almost no perceptible crater there. And if you look at pictures of craters of many other buildings, particularly a lot of them that's off the IRA in the UK, the craters are always very pronounced, and they have that rim. And it's not a matter of being covered up by debris. Usually all those craters, you can see, they're very, very, very clear. But in Oklahoma, there's almost very, very little perception of a crater in front of that building. Now, if you look at the structure of the building and the way it came down, in the reports that I turned out, I did a detailed analysis enough to show, with pictographic representation, that there had to have been at least four demolition charges that went off at the juncture of certain columns in the third floor. And all the information that I've been able to gather since that report was turned out way back in 1995 has done nothing but corroborate it. And there hasn't been, I've not seen a report, and I've tried to get everything that's been put out, a credible report analyzing what happened in Oklahoma City, except the FEMA report, and the FEMA report was actually not, I don't consider a credible report, because here you have a government agency involved in a study, and they happened to do their forensic work 200 feet away because the FBI wouldn't let them have access. And then when, you know, when the trial, when they brought the defense counsel and their experts, technical experts, to go through the building before it was imploded, they had to stick to very, very narrow tracks going through, and the building had been sanitized. The column stubs had been removed, and that was a big job. And the building was taken off, what had collapsed at the bombing had been taken off and buried. And I mean buried. I went out to that dump when they were out there burying it, and they had a piece of equipment out there. It looked like the kind of stuff you'd use, kind of equipment you'd use in surface coal mining. Literally burying the fourth of that building that came down with the explosion. So there's just been a massive cover-up. I think Dr. Brown is the seismographic gentleman from the University of Oklahoma. They had there were two seismographs, one about 4.5 miles away at the Omni Complex in Oklahoma City, and then one at the university about 17 or 18 miles away. That's rather interesting. The one that the complex 1.5 miles away, just a few minutes before the bomb went off, the power was shut off. And, but it had backup power on everything except the timeline. So in that, seismograph, and the FBI came out and confiscated that. But Dr. Brown, I think, did a very credible job, and, when the building was imploded and brought down, he compared the seismographic, information there with what happened back on the 19th of April, and, he came to some more conclusions. But I think it's very clear from the seismographic information there was more than the single truck bomb. And I know that when the people were making comments about Dr. Brown's work, I said, well, I didn't have to have Dr. Brown's work confirmed than I, because there are literally hundreds and hundreds of people in Oklahoma City, if you had several seconds between the burst, would have known it audibly. And I think that's the case, because there are many people in the building who were in the building and survived, and they had time to, from the first shake and rattling and floors rocking in the building till the bomb went off in the truck and blew the glass in several seconds, and they had time enough to, several of them thought it was an earthquake, and they actually got up and got under their desk because pieces of the suspended ceiling were coming down on them, and they got under the desk to protect themselves, and then the whole glass front of the building sprayed through the place, and a lot of people were killed by glass shards or severely injured by glass shards. So there's a tremendous amount of information out there that corroborates that, yes, there were explosive charges inside the building before that truck bomb went off. And there's just been a massive cover-up. And if you go back in history, you had the same thing after the Kennedy assassination. You had the Warren Commission. How many of you today, how many listeners out there believe the Warren Commission today? It was instituted as a cover-up operation, and I think it's what has happened with the cover-up by officials in Waco. I think probably one of the cleanest cover-ups probably was the bombing of the Trade Center in New York. It was clearly an FBI counterterrorism operation that supposedly, a sting operation that went bad, if it went bad. They had the people involved in that. The FBI had former Egyptian military officer who was a go-between between the FBI and the Middle East terrorist group. And he had taped all of his contacts with his FBI handler, and there were, I don't know, something like 85 hours of taped conversation, and they were going to run this sting operation and use this truck loaded with inert material and catch these guys in the act of trying to bring the building down and prosecute them. Well, they let the truck, they changed their mind at the last minute. I'm talking about the FBI. They changed their mind at the last minute and decided to use active explosives, live explosives. And they let the thing get in there and blow the building up. Well, actually, there's an organization here in Washington was hired to go in and run a detailed analysis of the damage of the building in the New York Trade Center. And what happened, they had this truck they had set up in the Trade Center in New York. You had two towering buildings that went up something over 1,000 feet. And they came out of this 6-story garage with 11-inch thick flooring. And the columns that went up in the towering part of the building were very, very large. And the columns that went up inside the garage were not nearly as big. And there was a cement block curtain wall surrounding the towering part of the building that is. It went down through the garage so nobody could get a vehicle or a bomb up against one of those columns. But they knew where the column was, and they were planning to put that truck bomb right up against the wall, like concrete block wall, which was closest to one of those humongous columns. And they put a barricade there to keep anybody from parking. So when they brought the truck back in the building to park it, they were going to park it there. Some New York parker had removed the barricade and parked there themselves. So they had to they set the bomb off in the drive, one in the passageway through the garage here, a vehicle length away from that column, further away from the column. Of course, the bomb wasn't big enough to take out that humongous column. It went up 1,000 feet, but it stripped all the flooring attachments to that column off, two floors up and three floors down. So you had a six-story high football-shaped column, football-shaped hole, cavity in that building, sort of surrounding one of these very, very large columns that went up 1,000 feet, over 1,000 feet. So if they had been able to bring that column down, which is what they were shooting for, you'd have had several thousand people killed in that building, not the five or six that were killed, and you had 500 injured and over $1 billion worth of damage. But clearly, in the New York Trade Center case, it was set up as a counterterrorism sting, and you can say gone bad, but this Middle Eastern or the Egyptian former military guy who was a go-between, was very irate with the FBI. He said, you knew it was coming, you could have stopped it, you didn't stop it, and he's very heartbroken because all those people got killed and all the damage and so forth. And the FBI gave him over $1,000 to help prosecute the case. All this was in one article, one day, one time, in the New York Times paper. You never saw it, I've never seen it anywhere else, publicized. So, what happened in Oklahoma? Was it a counterterrorism sting going along? We know that the building could not have been collapsed the way it was. We know there are a lot of other people involved in McVeigh who covered up things. I think the FBI's handling of this thing has been cover up from even beforehand, because information got out that there was a lot of prior knowledge, several sources, not just one source, but several knowledge sources of prior knowledge about the bomb going off, and it's sad. But this takes me back to why, if you had Ruby Ridge and the Trade Center in New York and the bombing, there was a bomb went off in the building at Waco and the church records vault. I was asked to do a forensic on that church records vault for a court case, and there was a demolition charge that went off. Can we say the FBI or whoever was there at Waco did it? I don't know who did it, but we know there were 28 women and children in that concrete block church records vault, and they had a demolition charge that went off right on top of it. So who set it off? I don't know, but they drove a tank, tracked vehicle into and through that building, and pushed all of the stuff in the kitchen, our industrial kitchen stuff, up against the only exit there to that church records vault. And did they have access to do it when they put that vehicle in there? Sure they had. They had plenty of time. They were in there a long time. Did they do it? I don't know. But there was a demolition charge set off on top of that church records vault. The explosion was there. The forensics on the hole says it was a high explosive, kind of a demolition charge. Some people have said it was a shaped charge. I don't know that. I've looked at all the forensic information available, and there's no evidence that there was a shaped charge, but, you know, there's a high explosive charge that was set off on that. There could have been a shaped charge if that jet had from that shaped charge had gone right between the rebar, which was left there clean as could be. And the only way you could tell that there was high explosive had gone off there, other than the features that you get from setting off high explosive in contact with concrete. In the region where the pressure from that explosion far exceeds the yield strength of concrete, you have a wave of deformation that moves through the concrete and just turns the concrete to very fine powder or dust, and the rebar, it's slightly cold work, but nothing happens to it other than that. If you want to know that it had seen high explosive charge in its immediate proximity, you make a photomicrograph out of a cross section, and you can tell that it has been cold work. That's a very easy, simple process. Would anybody ever do that? I'm not aware of that at all.
General Partner, I got to ask a question at this point, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You've been talking for a while. You're probably a little sore. But this tremendous information you're giving us here. I remember when you gave your talk, like I said, several years ago at the Bible camp, and I read your report. I'd seen your copies of your pictures that you had had both at that live presentation, and I've seen it in other places. It just, the question that comes to my mind, and I'm sure many other people, is in the face of such testimony as yours and many other people, but particularly yours, with all your experience, with all the documentation that you provided, all the common sense explanations as to what happened, who or what is so powerful that they can shut down the normal processes that we count on to bring justice to bear in this country? Who has that kind of power, and what is their agenda that they can just mock this kind of evidence and come up with conclusions that are totally ridiculous?
Well, this goes back to the program of the Third International, which I talked about at that conference, as you probably well remember. When you control the government, when you control the media, and you control the legal processes, there's not much that you can't do and get away with it. And that's kind of the situation that we have in this country. Let me just give you a case in point about control of the media. Today we have talk shows like this, we have the internet is getting information out. You have a lot of sources of information now that bypass the main networks and the main newspapers out there. And I think you're getting a lot more people informed in this country today, by far, than you ever have had before. But let me just give you a little example of the control of the media. I was invited out to a program called Extra, an ABC affiliate, and they wanted me to do an interview on their program called Extra. It's a one-hour program. And I agreed to go out. They sent me a first-class ticket out to Hollywood, and they met me at the airport with one of these half-block-long white limousines with everything you could think of eating and drinking. It was at my disposal for the evening, and they took me to the Sanford Hotel around. Next morning, they picked me up in that white limousine again, carried me over to the studio. And they had two producers set up, and both of them were young women, the age of my kids, in their 40s, and they were very sharp, and I thought they were very objective in what they were doing. They copied all the material I had and prepared everything that was to be shown in the interview, and I thought they did some things fairly well. And then when they were ready to shoot, in comes the interviewer. We went back, he met me at the front door, took me to a conference room, we sat down and had all these papers spread out, pictures spread out, all these pictures that were going, lots of talking, going around the studio. There was a lot of exposure of the producer, of the host, and Ben Parton. When the program was shown across the country on a Sunday, about a month after that interview, they let me make the major points that were made in that program. One, that it was technically impossible for the explosive charge the FBI said was there to have had the reach it had to bring down those heavily reinforced concrete columns. Secondly, it was technically impossible to get the growth of symmetry from a one-point demonstration, a one-point of detonation, and a fairly uniform building structure. In other words, the floors were pretty much all the same across the building facing the truck. There were no load-bearing walls. It was all heavily reinforced concrete. And about the only thing vulnerable in that building to that truck out there was flooring in the closer proximity to the truck. The flooring in that building was not designed to take very heavy industrial loads, so the flooring in there was the most vulnerable thing in the building, and not fairly close into the truck. So... If you look at that situation with the truck bomb out there, there's just no way that you could have gotten a very asymmetrical configuration in the damage to the building without demolition charges in the building. And the third point was they let me shoot down the FEMA report, which was a very specious report in many respects, but beautifully done and full color. And when that all came out in the show across the country about a month after I was out in California. Then they wound up the program by saying, well, General Parton is a career military officer. He's not an engineer. Therefore, he really doesn't understand these things in the program. So the whole purpose of the program was to get me out there, let people see what I had to say, and then undermine me by denying any credibility. They knew I had a B.S. in chemical engineering, a master's in aeronautical engineering, and had 2 years in armament engineering, and completed the academics for a Ph.D. in statistics with a minor in operations research. Spent a year, 2 years in the ballistic research laboratories at Aberdeen, getting my hands dirty, and I did the design and development work for the Bomark continuous rod warhead, which is probably one of the most difficult warhead kinds of warheads that you can build. So it's about as difficult as a pit of a nuclear weapon. And spent 25 years in the research and development, all the way from the laboratory to the Office of Secretary of Defense. And they just flat denied any credibility for passing judgment or competence in what the subject I was talking about. And flatly denying that I was an engineer. So I talked to some lawyers about suing those jokers, and they said, well, it would cost you everything you've got, and if you do win your battle, you'll get a dollar judgment, because you're both considered public people. So they got a lot deeper pockets than I have.
So here again, the people that control the money seem to control what's put out as truth.
Pardon?
The people who control the money seem to be the ones in the power to control what the public is told is true.
Well, who control the media. It is so extensive and it's been so systematically designed to... See, they don't care if 10% of the people get to know the truth. You just can't let too many know the truth so that you can have some real impact in response to what is told or the news out there. And the newspapers have the same problem. It's not always the case. I know there's one fairly major, large newspaper chain out there. When the founder died, he put in his will that the purpose of that newspaper would be to advance the basic proposition of eliminating the private ownership of property. And Lenin made the statement himself, said, you know, communism is simply the elimination of private ownership of property, which is a lot more than that. But here's a newspaper chain out there devoted to that premise. And if you look at the unions and the people out there who are working in the press and in the media, I remember in Cleveland, Ohio, I was there, and a member of our church who was the owner of the Plain Dealer. They had a humongous strike going on, and the strike, talking to the owners, they said the strike wasn't about working conditions or salaries or anything. The strike was trying to establish control of the editorial department and the news desk. So if you can control what news goes out, you can control the editorial department. You can control what the people are knowing, are going to learn. So that stuff has been going on for decades and decades, and unless you track it and know and understand the origin of a lot of this stuff and see where they're going, it's rather difficult to sometimes put it all together.
That's incredible. And I don't know, it just dumbfounds me that, again, somebody with your credentials, which anybody with any common sense would have to be in awe with the amount of background that you have, and for you to put together your presentation like you did down there in West Virginia, again, anybody with a modicum of common sense would have to say, at the very least, this needs to be looked into a lot more than it's being looked into. And not to mention the fact, like you just said, that they bulldozed a perfectly good building to the ground to hurry up and cover up the evidence. And then you find out we've got major governmental agencies like the FBI who are involved in cover-up. It sure doesn't make we the people feel very comfortable about all this.
Well, that's the sad case. And I was just involved with Mike McNulty in doing a new film which is out on the infrared aspects of the investigation that was conducted by Senator Danforth, headed up by Senator Danforth. And that effort, I can say unequivocally, was another cover-up. I got somebody put on the one of the stations on the internet made some comment that Danforth was another Warren Commission. And I think there's some I can appreciate that comment because in my experience in weapons and development of weapons, one of my big pushes all during the 60s and 70s was trying to get precision-guided weapons in basically the Air Force inventory. And I started a technology program to develop some of these new technologies, the infrared acquisition, infrared guidance, back in the 60s. And I did the first DCP for the Maverick missile, and then for the infrared Maverick, and then a lot of other stuff out there. And so I was on the ground floor of getting the infrared guidance technology and acquisition technology on the way back in the 60s and 70s. So I knew an awful lot about it. In fact, I had, when I was trying to get the people in the Department of Defense and the people in the Senate and House staffers to understand this technology, I had a piece of equipment put on a C-47 and brought to Washington. This is in 1973. To show them what you could do with target acquisition and weapon guidance in the infrared area. And at that time, you had cars were lined up at the gasoline stations a half a mile around Washington because of the big fuel shortage in 1973. Remember, Iran was just taken offline.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the targets we'd look at when we were sending this airplane out at night with the dignitaries on there, we were showing them what you could do with infrared, was a big gasoline tank farm just south of the beltway off of I-95. And you look at those fuel tanks out there when we had this big shortage and those fuel tanks were full. So you can take infrared and look at a fuel tank and see right precisely where the level of fuel is, because the temperature up to that fuel level takes on, you know, sort of a generalized temperature for the environment, but the top above the gasoline, it sort of takes on your ambient temperature. It varies from night to day, and the tank, that big lake of fuel and gas in there sort of stays the same temperature. So we can precisely see the fuel level in every tank. And when we had the big fuel crack, the big crunch in Washington, those fuel tanks were all full. So it was another big manipulation, which a lot of people don't know about. I know I served on an interdepartmental committee at the time looking to see what we could do about the long-term availability of portable fuel for military and commercial aviation at about the same time. And a lot of crazy things are going on that we learned. But anyway, I started to make a comment about the cover-up for Waco. We had the Danforth Committee. And then Mike McNulty pulled together some technical experts, and I was working on that as a IR guy. And you looked at all the things that happened out at Fort Hood, where they did this reenactment of the shootings into the buildings at Waco. And clearly, there are just dozens of things that are vivid. If you know the technology and look at what happened and what they did, they rigged the whole thing to give them the answers that they wanted, so that they could fudge what they had to make it look like. So that documentation is out there now on a new video called the Infrared Project, which if everybody listening ought to call and get a copy of it. But the cover-up goes on, and there's no question. Here you had the big committee, this big effort pulled together, headed up by former United States Senator and yet the thing was rigged. And I'm sure Danforth didn't have enough technical smarts to know what was rigged and what wasn't rigged. And the people, I'm sure, who were picked to work on that thing, maybe a lot of them did not or could not figure out the technology of what was done to rig it to turn out what the information they wanted.
So what we have, General, is that at the very top levels, what I'm hearing anyway, is that we have at the very top level of the government in this country, the people really aren't truly concerned with the truth.
Well, it's not only not concerned with the truth. They are working for, as I said before, when I was talking to that conference that you mentioned earlier, about the program of the Third International. And if you look at the program of the Third International, which they worked on from 1919 to 1928, it's 9 years. You had the best and brightest from around the world. I think they had 11 plenum meetings. The thing was put together and then it was circulated at the Fourth Party Congress and the Fifth Party Congress, and years two later, the Sixth Party Congress in 1928, they adopted it. And the next Global Party Congress they had was in 1936, I think, and at that part of Congress, the only thing they did, they reviewed the program, the only thing they did was put a little more emphasis on the United Popular Front kinds of efforts, you know, all the Communist Front kinds of things. And you find that activity, go back and look at the documentation back there right after World War II and during the McCarthy hearings, and you find that they were in all kinds of things. Now, 1957... one thing that the Christian people out there ought to remember and know. The year 1957, this was after the McCarthy hearings, this was the year of Sputnik. In 1957, all of the fellow travelers and communists around the world that were told there will no longer be any card-carrying members. Tear up your party cards, go join the church, work within a church organizational structure, go to seminary, but get involved in the religious efforts as your front. So consequently today, you've had many, many churches that have been destroyed, neutralized, or, the attendance has gone down, and you have this has been going on as a national, really, it wasn't a national effort, it was a global effort, because this wasn't something they just did in the United States, they did it globally. No more party cards after 1957, the year of Sputnik. I think everybody in the church organizations ought to know and understand that. I know we were going to a big church in Washington, D.C., and the pastor of that church had been the head of the American Baptist Association. And two couples came in there, very eager beavers, and very smart, very bright. They knew and understood their Bible, read it intellectually. And in 10 years' time, they destroyed that church in many respects. And I know we were going to a church that, for a long time here in Northern Virginia, and there's one couple there, the gentleman always stood up, he never sang a choir to the church, and never opened the hymnal, and never just stood there looking around. And in Sunday school, he'd always ask some question, trying to bend scriptures or misguide some by people. But I've had many, many discussions with him. He's a very doctrinaire socialist, and I'm sure, I just presume he's sitting there in that church waiting for the pastor to do something to give them reason to go to 501c3 or, prosecute him by the IRS.
But we definitely have muggle churches today. General, we only got about 3 minutes, and I know it's not much time, but I have to ask what your take is on what's going on with China and the fact that they got us surrounded with ports of entry for their COSCO shipping all around the United States. What's your take on all that?
Well, we need to talk about the program of Third International, and if you get into that, you'll see clearly what the story is. See, they are down to the point in this country and in the Western Hemisphere of trying to move a whole bunch of countries in the Western Hemisphere into the socialist camp. Right now, you have in Venezuela, they've taken Venezuela. You have a communist, the struggle in Colombia today today in Colombia, the struggle down there is what you call a war of national liberation. And it is in, now in the period of escalating violence. They're trying to move the United States from the preparatory phase, which is a non-violent, long-term effort to weaken, build a basis for the revolutionary struggle. And in this country, it has been prescribed for decades, the struggle in this country will be racial. In South Africa, it was tribal as well as racial. In Rwanda, it was tribal. In Canada, the struggle is the French separatist movement. So you have all these bases of the struggle, and you carry them up to a point, and then you move on from through the preparatory phase to the period of escalating violence, and then into the period of exploitation. South Africa is now in the period of exploitation. In other words, when you move in the period of exploitation, you're used as a base of operation against the next target structure. So China is in the period of exploitation, moving against the next target, which is the Western Hemisphere.
Incredible.
And all of these struggles, all of these terrorist acts that we have had for in the last several years now, all of them have been focused on disarming the American people. Before you move from the preparatory phase to the period of escalating violence, there are two things you always do. One, you eliminate the death penalty. Because when people get caught, when you start into a period of escalating violence, you still have a death penalty. Somebody can get executed. But if you remove the death penalty, nobody has anything to fear except going to jail. Then when the revolution goes to completion, the people have the hopes of becoming another Mandela or Fidel Castro or some kind of czar. So they have nothing to fear. So you have to get rid of the death penalty. The second thing you have to do before you move to the period of escalating violence is to disarm the people. And when that bomb went off in Oklahoma, what did they do? They tried to push legislation through the Senate and the House to disarm the people. Not get rid of bombs, but to disarm the people.
General, we're out of time.
I understand.
If it's all right, I'm going to contact you about coming on next week or whenever you're available.
Well, let's talk about 30, program on 30 international, and people can put the program together.
Okay. Thank you, sir, for being on the program.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in tonight, folks. Stay tuned at 9 o'clock for Pastor Wickson with the End Day Prophecy Hour. We'll see you tomorrow night at 7. Yahweh bless and keep your powder dry.
Listen to us worldwide on hbroadcast.com.